Thanks for tuning in to the Fairhaven Church Sermons Podcast. My name is Brandon Tates, and I'm the AVL Director here at Fairhaven, and we're so glad you've decided to join us. Fairhaven is a part of Harbor Churches, a multi-site church located in West Michigan, and we exist to help people find their way back to God. We hope this message helps you to take your next step in your faith journey. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Good morning, Fairhaven. My name's Jeremy. I'm one of the pastors here. And I just want to say again, we've said it already, but if you're here for the first time, maybe you're here because your kids were here during the week and then they drug you here so that they could stand on a stage and sing this morning. We're grateful that you're here. And if that's you and this is your first time or this is your fifth time or whatever, if we've not had the chance to meet, we would love the opportunity to do so. And I'm grateful you're here today because my hope is in the service today, you'll maybe get a glimpse of who we are as a church, because today we're starting a new series. We're calling the series Finding Our Way Back to God after our mission statement, our kind of the answer to the question of why do we do what we do? Why are we the church that we are? Well, we are here to help people find their way back to God. And we start this series because every year, as Greg's already shared, every year we're gonna gather together. We at Fairhaven are one of a multi-site church called Harbor Churches. We are one of six churches. And every summer, we all gather together on the shores of Lake Michigan at Camp Geneva to celebrate all of the stories of life change, of transformation that happened over the past year at each of our Harbor churches. It's what we call our one baptism. And so we look forward every year to doing that because it's not just the event I look forward to, right? The event is fun. But it's not just the event, it's all of the stories that enter into the waters of Lake Michigan of people whose lives have met up with Jesus in some significant ways, and they have said, yes, I'm in, to the call that Jesus first gave to his disciples. When he said, come, the life that you're living, the things that you're giving yourself to, come and follow me, give your life to me, chase after me, follow me, live your life in such a way that you're working to become like me. And every year in the waters of Lake Michigan, we get to hear story after story of people who have heard that call to come follow and have responded with a yes, and how their lives are continuously being changed by it. For me, it's one of the most powerful things because I can't help but think back to the time when God met up with me and I first heard that call and I responded and the difference it's made in my life. And so as we look forward to that, we think of some of the promises that Jesus made. Jesus said he came to be the way, the truth, and the life, that he came to bring us life and to give it to the fullest. And I've been thinking about that a little bit in these last few weeks, partly as I was looking forward to one baptism, partly as I was looking forward to this sermon and this series that we're in for the next few weeks, and partly because of a concert that I went to a few weeks ago. So just a few weeks ago, my friends and I, we were able to drive over to Pine Knob, it's out by Detroit, to see the Dave Matthews Band. Anybody ever see Dave in concert? Anybody ever go to Pine Knob? One of the coolest venues ever. It's like Michigan football game meets concert, right? Like I brought my Blackstone to the parking lot before a concert. And so we're making smash burgers in a parking lot. It was awesome. And then we went and we were able to see Dave Matthews, who's brilliant. He's fantastic. But so I have a thing that I do before really any concert that I ever go to. Maybe I'm alone. I don't think I'm alone. But what I'll do before I go to a concert is I will start like obsessively listening to the artist or the band I'm going to see for like days or weeks prior. Anybody else do this? Like, I found for me, concerts are always more fun if I really know well the songs that they might be playing at the concert. And so even somebody like Dave Matthews was like the soundtrack to my college, right? So like, I know the band pretty well, but I started listening to him on repeat, and you start with like the Apple Music Essentials album, right? So it's like all the popular ones. And then, you know, Dave's concert, he doesn't just play the bangers. So you have to get into the deep cuts. And so you chase the rabbit, right? But there's a song that Dave Matthews sings that always, the lyrics always have a way of like grabbing me. They do something to me. And they get me reflective, they get me thinking. It's the song, it's one of the top ones in the Essentials album. It's the song Ants Marching. The song starts this way. It says, he wakes up in the morning, does his teeth bite to eat, and he's rolling, never changes a thing, the week ends, the week begins. And the whole premise of the song essentially is that for so many of us, this is life. That tomorrow morning, you'll wake up on Monday morning and you'll do largely the same things you did last week Monday morning, which are largely the same things you did the prior Monday morning and the Monday before that and the Monday before that, and how so often life can just become this going through the motions where days blend into weeks, blend into months, blend into years, and at some point you stop and step back and go, is there something more? Is this all there is, that I am simply, as Dave labeled the song, just an ant marching, or is there more to it? And maybe the lyrics hit me a little bit more this last time because of something I actually learned over the last few months about ants. Can I geek out with you just a minute about ants? Yeah, this is why you came this morning, right? You were really hoping. Okay, next screen. This is a group of army ants. This is called an ant mill. It's called one of two things. They'll either call it an ant mill, or my favorite word for this is the death spiral. It sounds like something like Star Wars, doesn't it? Like, it sounds like you gotta add some bass, like the death spiral. So this is a death spiral. Essentially, the way this happens is you have a group of army ants. Army ants, you've seen ants, right? You know how ants walk. They kind of go one after each other in a line and they all follow each other, right? This giant game of follow the leader. What's interesting is with these army ants, apparently they're mostly blind. So they follow not because they can see what's in front of them or they can see where they're going, but the way they follow is they can actually kind of smell the ant in front of them. Usually it works well. They follow one after another and they follow in the single file line. What happens though, occasionally, is if that line gets broken by something, and now an ant can no longer smell the ant in front of it, that front ant, it kind of freaks out a little bit. Right? So it kind of like, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know where they went. Where did they go? And so like, it can't smell them. And so it kind of starts freaking out. And so now it's trying to figure out where to go. So it just starts walking until it picks up on the scent. What can happen is that now lead ant, who's a little freaking out, can pick up the scent of an ant further back in the trail, and they end up all following each other in a circle. They will do this in the ant mill or the ant death spiral until literally they die from exhaustion. I've actually got a video of an ant death spiral. But they will literally do that until they die. That's what they do. That is the ant mill. That is the ant death spiral. And so as I watched the video, as I was thinking about this Dave Matthews lyrics playing on my radio, I couldn't help but wonder, for how many of us, if we're honest, for how many of us doesn't life feel a little bit like that? Like we're just going through the motions. Monday turns into another Monday. The week ends, a new week begins. We never change a thing. And we are just constantly just walking through the motions. It can feel like we are just spinning in circles until one day, like the ants, we too die of exhaustion, asking the question, is this all that there is? Is there something more? And somewhere deep inside of us, there's that longing that what we don't want for our life is this, right? For some of us, we felt this. For some of us, we are in a spot where it feels like this. And the reality is, this is not what we planned for our life when we were young, right? If you would have asked each of us, any one of us, when we were 4 or 5, what do you want to do with your life? It's one of my favorite questions. Because 4 or 5-year-olds, they always have an answer, right? What do they want to do with their life? And what's interesting to me is when you ask a 4-year-old what they want to be when they grow up, that 4-year-old isn't thinking that like they've got to find a source of income because there's bills and there's mortgages and like housing prices. And so like they've got to make sure that they can support a family. They aren't thinking about any of that stuff yet. And yet they have an answer for what they want to be and what they want to do when they grow up. And so it feels like it comes from somewhere else when asked of a young kid, right? And so many of the answers feels like, well, we have dreams of giving ourselves to things that are bigger than us, right? Like how many of us as kids wanted to be firemen or policemen or like we want to give ourselves to something bigger, to live a life that has meaning, that has significance. And then some of us, we grow up and the bills start coming in the mail and we start making some decisions. And before we know it, we've given up on the dreams and we feel like we're a bunch of ants spinning in a circle waiting until we just drop over. So is there a better way? Is this all that there is? Or is there more? See, over the next few weeks, we're going to be exploring that. We're going to be talking about that more. And we're going to do it by all kind of looking at one story. So if you want to follow along, we are going to be this week and the upcoming weeks. You can just go ahead and put a bookmark in Luke chapter 15. Now, before we start Luke 15, what we find in Luke chapter 15 is the entire chapter is essentially kind of 3 stories that Jesus tells. Jesus, actually about 30% of what we have recorded that Jesus taught comes in the form of story. We call Jesus' stories parables. And one of the questions then is, why does Jesus do so much in story? Well, the rabbis actually had a way of talking about parables where they said the parables are essentially like putting handles on the truth. That you have something that's true, you have something that Jesus is teaching, but once you put it into a parable, it gives it handles in a way that you can carry it. Example, we still kind of tell parables. We might not call them parables, but when my kids were young, the example I always use is I could tell them, and we did tell, my wife and I, we did tell our kids that like, it's important that you always tell the truth. Don't lie. If you lie, people might not believe you, right? You've told this to your kids. You've told this to people. You can tell them. And then there's a story that we use, right? You know the story. It's a story about a boy who cries wolf, right? In the whole story, there's a boy who kept crying wolf, even though there was no wolf. He did it over and over and over again so that when the wolf showed up, nobody believes him. You can just say the sentence, don't lie, make sure you tell the truth. But then once you put it in the story, it kind of gives you handles. It gives you a way to hold on to it. Often, Jesus teaches in parables. He's giving handles to the truths that he's teaching. And in Luke chapter 15, there's kind of 3 stories that in a lot of ways have kind of a parallel. They're kind of in a lot of ways teaching the same thing. Jesus is going to start with a parable about a shepherd who loses a sheep. You might remember the story. He leaves the 99 to go find the one who was lost. So the first story is about a lost sheep. Second story is about a woman who loses a coin and will stop at nothing to get the coin she lost back. First story, lost sheep. Second story, lost coin. The third story is the story we know as the prodigal son. It's the story when a son is going to flee from home. We call it the prodigal son. I wonder, as we explore the story in the next few weeks, if you wouldn't agree with me that it probably makes more sense to call them the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. And so what we're going to do is over the next handful of weeks, we're going to dive into this story. So this morning, we're going to read it in its entirety, and then we're going to go back, and we really today are only going to look at the very beginning, the kind of setting the stage for the story. So Luke chapter 15, let's start at 11. Jesus continued, said, there is a man who had 2 sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his field to feed the pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and I'll go back to my father and I'll say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and put sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. And meanwhile, the older son was in the fields. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. And so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Jesus tells this story about this prodigal son. And so this morning, we're really only going to dive into the very beginning, kind of the setting, the scene, the context of the story. And then I want to encourage you to come back over the next few weeks because they will continue to build on the work that we start today. But today, I just want to start with the way Jesus sets the scene. So if I just put the first couple of verses back, it says there was a man who had two sons. So immediately we find out the characters in our story, right? We have dad and we have two sons. We have an older son and we have a younger son. The younger one says to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So dad divides property between them. And then the next one, not long after, he's gonna go off and squander. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. So we have dad, we have two sons, and then we have a movement in place, right? We have wherever dad lives, wherever dad's house is, and then we have wherever this distant land is. And now Jesus doesn't tell us specifically where dad lives and where the distant land is, but Jesus gives enough details in the parable that I think we can at least have some mental images about what's going on kind of behind the story, about the types of places Jesus is thinking about the types of places that Jesus' audience would have been thinking about when they heard the parable. Because dad, it's obvious this younger son grew up in this good religious Jewish family in likely one of the smaller religious Jewish villages in the Galilee, because Jesus is speaking to the Pharisees. He's speaking to the religious people about this little farm family. And so I want to show you an image. I want to give you kind of some mental imagery about what home likely would have looked like. So if we start with a map, All right, so we have the nation of Israel. Jesus called home the city of Capernaum. Does Jesus say the story happens in Capernaum? No. But Capernaum is going to give us an image of what a first century Jewish village would have looked like. Actually, in that whole area, kind of north of the Sea of Galilee there, that area was littered with all of these kind of small Jewish religious villages that we can still go to today. And in a lot of ways, they kind of model themselves after each other. Like they're all built kind of the same way. And so I want to show you a picture of Capernaum. If we were to drop on the ground today in Capernaum, it looks like this. So you see all those like half walls, those kind of little couple foot tall walls. Those would have been walls to kind of the houses and the rooms. What we know is in a little Jewish community, you don't live by yourself over on the hill outside of town. What happens is you live together in community. So you live with your family. Your houses have multiple rooms. You live with your family. You live in your community. That's the Sea of Galilee just in the background. But this is largely what most of the Jewish villages look like. If we're standing at this vantage and we turn 45 degrees to the left, what we find is this. So in the front, you can still see kind of the remains of those first century houses. And then in the back, you see that building. That is a synagogue. That synagogue, that was actually rebuilt a couple hundred years after Jesus, but it was rebuilt on the same foundation. So that synagogue still sits in exactly the same place that Jesus would have stood and taught when he lived in Capernaum, when he called this place home. But what you find in the little Jewish religious villages is houses are close together. Community is important. They're small, they're modest, and the villages are centered on the synagogue. Because the synagogue is the center of your life. It's the center of your religious life. It's the center of your social life. Your life revolves around worship, around your faith, around the synagogue. It's where the kids go to school. It's where you learn Torah. This is what a little village would have looked like. And now, I know it's hard to get a mental image of a bunch of walls that are only a couple feet tall. And so I want to show you a picture. They've actually recreated a first century village just a little bit north. It's a village that doesn't show up in our Bible, but was a first century Jewish village. So if we show the next slide, this is largely a recreated small Jewish village. They've built the houses. Houses are basically one room. You might have a guest room, a cataluma attached where a visitor could stay. Might make sense of the Christmas story. But it's largely small, quaint. Houses are all right next to each other. Community is important. And there is a synagogue in the middle of the village. This is the mental imagery Jesus' audience is going to have of where dad is going to live, of where the younger son is going to grow up, of where older brother is still living. It's this small religious village. We know the younger son, he gets sick of this, right? He gets sick of the small and the modest, and he has that question, right? Is there something more? Is there more? What else is out there? And so what we know in the story is he travels off to a distant land, it says. Now, when we say distant land, what do you think of? Like, I'm thinking you probably have to jump on an airplane and travel somewhere significantly different than home. In Jesus' world, that could have been true, but it can also represent a significant different worldview, a significantly different way of life. And some of the details in the story, I think, give us some imagery. If we go back to the map, I want to show you, if we start in Capernaum, I want to bring you just south to a city known as Scythopolis. Scythopolis was one of a number of cities like it. If Jewish villages were all kind of the same, cities like Scythopolis, in a lot of ways, were all kind of the same because Scythopolis was one of what we know as the Decapolis. Deca means 10, polis is city. It's one of the 10 cities. This is not a religious Jewish village. This is a Greco-Roman city. And what we find is the way of life for a small religious Jewish village and a Greco-Roman city could not be more fundamentally opposite. You show up at Scythopolis, and what you find is this. You find a theater. They've rebuilt about half of it. You can tell the stone keeps going up on the top right. You find theater. They have entertainment. They will have plays in the theater. You come down and look at kind of the portico. The next one. Next slide. So you've got pillars. You've got in the far background, you can see a number of pillars. All of the major streets. If we go to the next slide, this is the major streets. They have pillars all the way down them. There are shops on the sides. You will find temples to all of the Greco-Roman gods. You will find brothels. You will find homes for prostitutes. You will find what Scythopolis, what the Decapolis, what the Greco-Roman cities of the first century promised is whatever you want, we have for you. Whatever your heart desires, whatever you want, you come here and you will find it. There's theater. There's gymnasiums. There's entertainment. There are shops. There's this place promises to give you everything. Now, one of the reasons I think we know this is kind of the mental imagery in the story is when the younger brother goes there, spends everything he has, it falls apart. Do you remember what he ends up working with? Pigs. What is something you will never find in a Jewish village? Pigs. Literally, excavations, we can know when we dig something out of the dirt, whether or not it was Jewish or Greco-Roman, largely simply by the existence or absence of pig bones. If there are none, likely Jewish. If they are, Greco-Roman. And so some of us, we all of a sudden just got the draw to the Greco-Roman Decapolis, right? Like theater, who cares? Like the gym, who cares? But like, you know, pigs mean like, we're talking bacon. We're talking tenderloin. Like we're talking pulled pork, right? Like apparently in the ancient world, you know you're getting close to the Decapolis when you see the smokers, like the smoke rising in the air, right? In our story, younger son grows up in this small religious village and has something inside him that's asking, is there something more? Is there something more? He has that desire, that longing for something different than what was, and so he ends up going to chase it. So this morning I want to talk just a little bit about that, because what I appreciate in the parable is Jesus doesn't tell us why the younger son left, right? We know he asked for his share. We know he took off for a distant country. We know he squandered everything he had. We don't know why, what drove him to leave, what drove him to go there. But I want to play with that drive, the longings that each and every one of us have, because the decisions we make, the things that we give ourselves to, the things that we do, largely often we're chasing something inside of us, right? We have that longing to live lives that matter. We have longings for purpose. We have longings for love. We know he's going to end up visiting the brothels in whatever foreign city he runs off to. But each and every one of us, we're driven by those longings inside of us. That for many of us, we have that longing for love, right? We have that longing to be loved, to love, to be accepted. It reminds me of a guy, this guy right here. His name is Glenn Wolfe. If we go to the next slide, Glenn Wolfe. Glenn Wolfe is, I guess I'll say popular, but he's popular for a really weird, bizarre reason. Glenn Wolfe is known as being the person who's been married the most times. Wikipedia debates itself a little bit, whether that number was 29 or 31. It looks like the 31st was probably a publicity stunt, so we'll at least throw that one out. So it was somewhere likely between 29 and 30. A few times he married the same person a couple times, but 29 to 30 times this man was married, and maybe the more shocking part is the whole time he was getting married and unmarried and remarried, he served as a Baptist pastor. Which means the one thing you know at all of the receptions is that man was not on the dance floor, right? You throw a picture of a guy like Glenn Wolfe on the screen. On the one hand, we can throw the guy under the bus. It's really easy to start throwing jabs. But one of the questions I want to ask is, Why did he keep trying? Right, when the first one failed, and the third one, and the seventh one, and the 15th one, why did he keep trying? Why at some point didn't he just say, you know what, forget it, it didn't work, I'm done, I'm out? I think some of us know why he kept trying, right? Because we've been in those spaces where we have this longing for love. We have this longing to love, to be loved, to be accepted. And for some of us, we know the pain of having it not work out, right? For some of us, we've had the moments where we've stood on a stage in front of our family and friends. We've made promises. We meant the promises. We stood behind the promises only to see them turn and walk away, right? For some of us, it was the close friend. It was the family member, a sibling, a parent, a child, somebody who you have made promises to that they should have been there and they weren't. And yet something deep inside of you continues to want, to desire, to long for that love and to be loved, to be accepted, that we have this longing for love. I think we have a longing for purpose. It's why when you ask the four-year-old, what do you want to do with your life, right? What you often don't get are questions about income and status. And what you get is, I want to give my life to something that matters. That for so many of us, especially if we feel like we're stuck in the death spiral, right? We're asking ourselves, what does it look like for my life to have purpose, for my life to matter in the long run, or for those around me, for those outside of me? And then I think we have longings for meaning. We want to make sense of the world we live in, right? We want the world to make sense. For so many of us, we find ourselves asking these big questions of why when it doesn't. It's why we actually spent the last handful of weeks looking at some of those big questions, because we have these longings for meaning, for life to make sense. That in the story, this younger son, for whatever reason, he got sick of life at home. He's asking, is there something more? And so he chases it. And he runs to this foreign country, this far off land. And what he finds is he tries to pursue this longing for love, right? The older son said he blew all of the money on prostitutes. And what we find is the younger son, he goes looking for love. And he finds himself more alone and more isolated, and more, he did not find what he was looking for, right? To quote you too. But we find that he wanted purpose, he wanted meaning, and he went out looking for it on his own terms. And what we find is he went and chased it, but he didn't find what he was looking for. And he eventually comes to the realization, as we'll get into in the next few weeks, that maybe what he wanted, he didn't have to run anywhere for. Because the thing about longings is we can read the story and go, okay, so the desires, those things are bad, and he should have tried to squash those because they led him over there. But if we're honest and we look at it, some those longings themselves aren't bad, right? The longing for love, the longing for purpose, for meaning, they're not bad. I would actually go the opposite direction and say they were built in us by God himself at the creation, right? We looked at the book of Genesis a while ago, and we looked at how we were created in the very image of God, and God is a God of love, of purpose, of meaning. And so those things in themselves are not bad. The question that we should be asking is, where do they drive us? Where do they drive us? Do they drive us closer to God, the one who created them in us? Or do they drive us to our own ends? Do they drive us further away as we are trying to chase them down, as we're trying to find fulfillment in them on our own means, by our own means? The question is, where are they driving us? So over the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at a handful of what we're kind of calling awakenings, that as we look forward to one baptism in the shore of Lake Michigan at Camp Geneva, we celebrate on the one hand that call that Jesus gives to come follow, On the one hand, we celebrate that first time when we respond, right? That very first time when we give our lives over to him, when we say yes, that we're gonna follow. But if we're honest with our lives, often what life is yes, there's that big moment when we respond, but there's also a whole lot of other moments where we find that we're living a story that's lost the plot, where we've gone to a place that we shouldn't be. Our life has gone off the rails. And in a lot of ways, there is a constant returning and recalibrating and constantly saying yes again and again and again to following after, chasing after, to being modeled by the way of Jesus. And so this first week is really just awakening, being made awake to the very longings, those desires, the why we do what we do. And then where is it they drive you? Is it to trying to satisfy them on your own ends? Or do they drive you closer to the one who created you? And maybe a question. In the story, we had that small Jewish village, right? Community. It was love, it was faith, it was built on and grounded in the faith that the village shared. And then you had Scythopolis, the Greco-Roman city of the Decapolis, which promised whatever your desires are, you can find them fulfilled here. It's all about you. You don't have to worry about what anyone else thinks. You don't have to worry about anyone else. You can just be you, do you, live for you. The Jewish village or the Greco-Roman Decapolis, maybe a question is, which city are you currently finding yourselves in? What city right now is home? Right? Is it here or is it there? As we become awakened to the longings, the desires, the drives, the why we do what we do, to ask ourselves the question, where are we? And in what ways, over these next few weeks, might we too need to make a turn to head back home? Oh, would you pray with me? God, that you are a God who is continually arms wide open, welcoming us back home. God, we are grateful. God, for all of the ways that you have been and are working in this church, in this community, in our neighborhoods, in your world. God, we pray that you would continue to draw more and more people to yourself, that more and more of us might find that life that you promised, that life to the full, that we know we don't find from chasing it on our own means, but that we know is only found in you. God, may we look to you for it. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. As you are tuning in, our hope is that you were encouraged and inspired to take the next step in your faith journey. For service times and for more information about how you can become a part of Fairhaven, you can visit us at fhchurch.org. Have a great week.